R is 145, and the date being 11 May 1983, the place is room 124, the judiciary hearing room located in the Capitol Building in Juneau, Alaska. Members present for the hearing today are Representative Barnes, Representative Liska, Representative Coxon, and myself, Representative Bussell. We have an expanded calendar of issues today. The first of which we'd like to do is HB 293, an act relating to definition of term of agency and the Ombudsman's Act. And Representative Ward is here at this time to make a statement. Representative Ward, since we are recording electronically, I'd like you to state your name for the record prior to proceeding with the statement.
Thank you. My name is Representative Jerry Ward. I'm from District 13, which is in Anchorage. And what this basically does, the legislation, Mr. Chairman and committee members, it does make the Alaska Bar Association an agency. If for a brief history on the background of why this has come to be, it was drawn to my attention in 1979 and ongoing today. In 79, there was a complaint that was entered in against the Alaska Bar Association, and it was at that time the Bar Association's opinion that they were not an agency and they opposed the Ombudsman from going in and looking at the records. They said, since you were a member of the Alaska Bar Association, Mr. Moody did, the judge, you can look at him anyway, but you can't look at him in your official position. Then next year, the legislature terminated the Alaska Bar Association, sunset it, and after the termination, it was in the lapse date of June the 30th, 1981. In 1981, legislation was offered, and one of those, the earlier versions, clearly stated that the Alaska Bar Association should be considered an agency. There, right now, the process of the Ombudsman's Office, when people call in and they have concerns about the Alaska Bar Association to the Ombudsman's Office, the Ombudsman, because this matter has not been clarified by the legislature, and since the position of the bar has not changed, he has instructed his staff to not take the complaints until the matter of whether or not the Alaska Bar Association is an agency or not has been determined by the legislature. I draw your attention, I believe it's in all your packets, the March 31st, 1983 letter from the Ombudsman's Office. And I think that this is consistent. I think that we do need to treat this group as an agency. They're named throughout the Constitution. They refer to the organized bar, organized state bar throughout. They are an instant part of it. They do have every other function of an agency other than they do not come under the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman. I don't think that the complaints that are issued to the Ombudsman's Office are large right now, but there appears to be nine of them or something like that at a time, a year, and but they're sufficient to where the public should have some form of recourse to them. Currently, right now, we have 1,865 attorneys in the state of Alaska. These are all members of the Alaska Bar Association. That's one officer of the court, one member of the Alaska Bar Association for every 241 people. So we are well represented. It's the largest agency that we have in the state of Alaska. It's a tremendously strong lobbying union, and I think that they should be part of the agency. I don't think that this is going to affect the integrity of the association whatsoever. I think it gives an outlet to the public, and I would just close with that.
I don't even have a question. The only part of your testimony I'd possibly disagree with is how strong a lobbying body the Bar Association
is.
We do have some fellow named Randall Burns at the Anchorage that wants to make a statement on this thing. If you don't have any questions, other questions, or any words right now, we'll dial him up and see what he has to say.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one other observation? The Ombudsman's Office, they do not have to be an attorney in order, They do not have to be an attorney to hold that office. So where it was our right for past Thomas Redmond and the current one, the next one may not be an attorney. And that's where the problem comes.
I think they have to be attorneys, they don't have to be admitted to the last bar. Yes, is Randall Burns in, please? This is Charlie Bustle, and I'm calling from the House Judiciary Hearing Room in Juneau.
Just a moment, please.
This is Randall Burns.
Mr. Burns, I'm Charlie Bustle, and I'm at the House Judiciary Hearing Room in Juneau, and we do have you on a speaker at the Judiciary Hearing today. The matter at issue is House Bill 293, an act relating to the definition of term agency in the Ombudsman's Act. You had wished to make a statement on the bill?
Yes, sir. Thanks for calling. I have prepared some statements, and I would like to read those, if I could.
We are ready at this time, if you would.
Okay. I would like to first thank the members of the House Committee for taking the time to hear this, the Bar Association, on the bill, and I will attempt to keep my comments brief and be pleased to answer any questions you might have when I'm through. To begin with, I must tell you that the Association is opposed to the present amendment to the Ombudsman's Act. We feel there are very valid reasons for finding that this amendment, duplicates legislative responsibilities, would waste staff time and money of both the Bar Association and the Ombudsman's Office. And according to Jack Chenoweth, the bill does not correct any public need. As you are no doubt aware, the Alaska Bar Association is a strange beast. While the Association is integrated by statute, and the powers of the Board of Governors and its areas of responsibility, delineated in the Integrated Bar Act, the actual rules detailing bar governance are contained for the most part in language adopted by the court, as we are also considered and acknowledged to be a significant part of the justice system here in Alaska. Thus it is that we find ourselves between two masters. The Association has a history, however, faced with its dual parentage, of occasionally running to one or the other of those parents for help. Recently, however, we've matured considerably, and that maturity manifests itself in the recent June 1982 agreement that was signed by both the Bar Association and the Legislature's Budget and Audit Committee. This agreement resulted from a dispute over access to bar records and was reached because the Bar Association recognized that the Legislature, on behalf of the public's interest, must be able to assure the public that the Association is competently and professionally providing services to the public as regards the admissions of attorneys to the practice of law, and once admitted, the discipline of those attorneys. Therefore, the bar, with the court's consent, has agreed to open its ordinarily confidential files and records to the legislature's Budget and Audit Committee for the performance audit that's a part of the sunset review process. The agreement is significant in that it reflects the association's desire to assist the legislature in evaluating our performance, and because the legislature, in signing the agreement, also recognized that the association is an integral part of the justice system and was sensitive to the fact that it ultimately is the court's responsibility to set standards for persons admitted to the practice of law and for the discipline of those once they are admitted. One of the main reasons, then, that the association is opposed to House Bill 293 is that it appears to conflict with our agreement, and secondly, it clearly appears to duplicate review procedures when there seems little justification for additional review by another agency of the legislature, in this case, the Ombudsman's Office. Jack Chenoweth stated to me 2 weeks ago, when I inquired whether his office had been asked to submit a fiscal note on this bill, that since his office had apparently received only 5 or 6 calls pertaining to the Bar Association last year, that he saw no need to submit a fiscal note to account for the cost of investigating so few complaints. I would agree, but the association then questions the need for such an amendment at all when there are so few calls, and especially when the Bar Association itself already spends a major portion of its entire annual budget on discipline and admission. As you may or may not be aware, the Alaska Bar Association receives no public funds for its operational expenses, except for $9,000 from the governor's contingency fund in order to pay for the cost of the 3 non-attorney members which are now appointed by the governor subject to legislative confirmation, and who sit on the Board of Governors. The $9,000 was taken from the governor's contingency fund after a letter signed by President Krutula and House Speaker Hayes expressed the legislature's belief that the fund was the proper place out of which to pay for those members' travel and per diem. The bar receives most of its operating funds from the mandatory dues paid by its members. Currently, for instance, an active member of the bar pays $310 a year. The Bar Association receives and processes some 60 grievances or inquiries a quarter. The association recently employed another full-time attorney to assist in the processing and investigation of disciplinary complaints. The bar now funds entirely out of dues paid by its members and at no cost to the state over $200,000 a year to support the discipline functions of the bar. The complaint procedures are reasonable, and by court order, the attorney complained against must comply with our request for information or be subject to discipline simply for failing to cooperate with the Bar Association. In fact, already twice this year, attorneys have been publicly censured by the court for failing to cooperate with the association's investigation. The Ombudsman has no such similar authority to insist on cooperation. As regards the admissions process, the Bar Association has spent considerable time and money improving the bar exam itself as well as the admissions process. This year alone, the bar has budgeted $115,000 for the admissions, only part of which is defrayed by the fee charged applicants taking the bar. These two areas would be the areas out of which most complaints might erupt, but apparently few members of the public feel necessary to go to the Ombudsman for help. Why should they when their complaints are energetically handled by the Bar Association? What I think you will have if the association is included with the Ombudsman's purview is a lot of people unhappy over the outcome of their divorce or a court case or unfortunate and unavoidable court delays calling the Ombudsman simply to complain. That doesn't happen now, but no doubt it would if the door was opened. The Bar Association competently and efficiently processes complaints against attorneys. It also administers, under strictest procedures, the bar exam. And these are the two areas, as I stated, where we assumed our actions would be subject to review by the Ombudsman's office. But we do have to ask, would it be limited to those areas? Specifically, I asked the members of the committee to consider what exactly is the intent of the current language in this Ombudsman's Act. Since every attorney must be a member of the Bar Association in order to practice law in this state, would a member of the public then be able to complain to the Ombudsman about their particular attorney? What about the attorney-client privilege? What if one side in a civil case, for instance, is unhappy and complains to the Ombudsman? If I, as John Q. Citizen, the other party in this case, would my attorney be dragged into this matter as a part of the investigation? And what then happens to my rights to privacy? The above is obviously a parade of horribles, but the intervention of the Ombudsman into the realm of the justice system through the back door of the Alaska Bar Association has far-reaching implications that must be examined before action would take on this matter. People need to feel free to discuss matters with their attorney, tax matters, family matters, estate planning, real estate and business transactions, wills. All of those matters should be solely between the individual and his or her attorney. That freedom would be unjustly curtailed if we have to be concerned about the possible intervention by the Ombudsman's office and to our personal matters. That's not currently the role of the Ombudsman, but this proposed language would create a serious problem, it seems to us. The Bar Association's procedures as set forth by court rule explicitly protect the attorney and client confidentiality, particularly when the legislature, in its agreement with the association, has provided the means by which to audit the performance of the Alaska Bar. And in view of the very minor number of complaints received, and finally recognizing that the state currently bears none of the cost of these investigations, and that this might drastically change, the Bar Association would urge the House Judiciary Committee to recommend against enactment of House Bill 293. The proposed amendment is not something the Ombudsman's office has requested, nor has there been an outcry that the public is not being well served by the Bar Association's current discipline and admissions procedures. No one will deny that this has always been the case, but the association has done much to correct problems that it's identified over the last couple of years. I happen to be a proponent of government in our lives because I believe the public has a right to unbiased service. As director of the bar, but also as a non-attorney, I feel that I can, without hesitation, vouch for the objectivity of the bar's current admission and discipline procedures. But like most of you, I also do not believe in duplication of effort. That is wasteful and costly and not justifiable in view of today's shrinking revenues, particularly when the legislature has an avenue through which to verify the Bar Association's performance of its mandated statutory functions. It seems unreasonable to add levels of bureaucracy and additional cost when no need has been demonstrated. At the very least, if you wish to go forward on this amendment, the Bar Association would request, prior to a vote in this matter, that the committee seek advice of counsel on the matter of the extent of the Ombudsman's role if the amendment is passed as currently written. If such language would allow review of individual attorney records, then I think every private citizen should be placed on notice of this bill and its intent be made well known. The chilling effect of such an amendment on our right to representation and privacy should not be set aside so casually, an amendment to the Ombudsman's Act. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Representative Coxon has a question.
Is this, does that machine pick me up? Randall, can you hear me?
Yes.
A couple of questions, Randall. First of all, I'm a little confused about your argument about duplication. I guess the argument is that because the bar's dispute with the legislature is resolved and that in fact the bar is subject to sunset review and legislative budget and audit has the power now to review the Bar Association, that's sufficient review and that the addition of this language to the Ombudsman's Act would be duplication. Is that the argument?
Yes, that's basically correct. It seems to us that if what would happen, and let's now step back from the concern that we have about the issue of what is the actual impact of the language that's in there now. Let's just say that in fact that we're limited to, basically as they are, to reviewing decisions of administrative agencies, which I guess in this case the Bar Association would be considered. Then we go through our entire process, and that is, in fact, do the investigation, make a determination about whether or not to go forward, and then at that point, it seems to me if someone wishes to complain what they're doing about how our process went and whether or not we were objective in our determination and whether or not, in the old phrase, if we have the hen, the fox, or the whatever it is about watching the hen house. Pardon me, I can't remember the cliche here. But my concern is that you have an avenue, which is the performance audit, which we've agreed to, despite our confidentiality rules, we have agreed to that audit so that there can be at some point on a fairly regular basis a review of our performance. Why then we would also, it seems to me, intervene with the Ombudsman's Office into areas that are confidential, you know, it could be on a fairly regular basis, it seems to me, and a costly and time-consuming to both agencies. And I really do think it's duplication, and I think we're performing those functions competently now, and that since you have that avenue, that's sufficient check on our performance at this time.
Well, I guess I don't agree with you, Randall, and the reason is that almost all other agencies are subject to that same sunset review and are also under the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman's Act. So almost every other agency of state government has that duplication now, that they can be investigated as part of the sunset review, and they can also be investigated by the Ombudsman. And particularly, I might point out, all of the other regulatory agencies of state government, the Alaska Transportation Commission, all of those, as I understand it, are within the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman's Act, and they're also subject to sunset review. So I guess I'm not convinced that I agree it's duplication. I'm not convinced that it's
bad. Well, I think the other point is, and I think it's a valid one, is that those are also public agencies whose time is being paid for out of public monies for that review. And we currently fund ourselves entirely with bar dues money, and as long as there is some manner, and I guess I'm going back to the issue of the separations of powers here, as long as there's some avenue for the legislature to review our actions and come to conclusions about our performance, that those other two areas, which is the fact that we're also office of the court and under the purview of the court system, and the fact that we are totally funded outside of the state system, that those issues also need to be taken into account here. And I think thirdly, there's the issue of the need, and I haven't seen nor have And of course, I'm not down there, so I haven't heard testimony to the contrary, but I've certainly not been aware of, and letters have not been sent here demanding that this be opened up because of people feeling they're not being well served by our current procedures.
Well, I guess, Randall, again, I'm not convinced that money is the only thing that makes an agency a public agency, that Bar Association is clearly performing a public function, otherwise you couldn't require membership. You're pretty clearly a public agency, and I wouldn't have to belong to the association if it weren't a quasi-governmental organization, whether or not it gets money or not. We've delegated some pretty important powers to the Bar Association, we and the court system, and I guess that isn't compelling to me. Let me move to the next question, though, and this is one that is a serious question. The question of confidentiality of documents. Are you testifying today that you believe, if you were under the jurisdiction of the ombudsman, that the ombudsman would have the right to subpoena privileged attorney-client information without the consent of either the attorney or the client?
Well, I think that's a question that's open and needs to be decided. At one time, if my memory serves me, there was a request by the ombudsman's office for files of the Bar Association. And those files were granted to the ombudsman in his capacity as an attorney of the association, but again, limited only to financial records, and were denied, I believe, by Judge Moody to the ombudsman, who was Frank Flavin at the time. But I think since it says includes the Alaska Bar Association, the Alaska Bar Association is an entity of the state, an instrumentality of the state, who's, as you pointed out, consists of members who must pay bar dues and who are automatically members of the association. So I do think there needs to be, and we have not done ourselves had time to do much research into the question, but I certainly think it at least opened the question of whether or not the ombudsman would have the ability to reach down not only just to the Bar Association as an agency, as the basically quasi-governmental agency, but also into the performance of the individual members of the association
pick it up,
and I think that's a valid question. I think that could be clarified perhaps by some language that indicated that we were talking about the Bar Association in terms of its administrative capacity, but I think that's something that needs to be clarified.
I think there's a distinction, at least in my mind, however, with regard to access of records when one of the parties consents, that is, where a client is complaining about his or her attorney, takes that complaint to the Bar Association, to the Ombudsman, probably ought to take it to the Bar Association, but takes a complaint to the Ombudsman and thereby waives his or her right to confidentiality. I don't have any problem whatsoever with subpoenaing records under that circumstance.
Well, what about the other side? That's our other question. Now, what if it involves it's a case where it needs an order, the Ombudsman determines that in order to make a valid investigation, there's the other side to the case that must also be reviewed, and whether or not the attorney and the client on the other side are going to find themselves in a compromising position.
Well, the problem, I think, arises only in the situation where the records that are sought by the ombudsman are records of people other than the complainant.
Right, I'm not disagreeing with that.
And in that situation,
even so, with the current system for the Bar Association, a complainant is requested and certainly encouraged not to, during an investigation, if we file a formal grievance and are going through the discipline process, there is certainly restrictions on what the attorney can and cannot say, but since the grievant is a member of the public, those similar restrictions don't exactly exist on that person, but we encourage confidentiality only because it can obviously, as in any court case, have a bearing on the outcome. And so, but you're right, if the grievant wants to go forward and make public what he has in his or her records and files, that's something that they can do.
So it seems to me the only case where at least I would be concerned about the ombudsman getting involved and getting confidential records is where those records are not, where the access to them has not been waived. That is, whether they're
That's
secret
right.
records and the plaintiff or the complainant is not the one whose records they are.
That's right.
Seems to me we could solve that by just inserting in this legislation that nothing in this legislation is intended to waive the attorney-client privilege.
Yeah, I think there needs definitely to be that, I think.
Thank you very much, Randall. Well, wait a minute. Representative Barnes has a question.
Randall, you said that there has been 60 complaints filed against attorneys within the last year. And I would like to know, of those 60, how many you have adjudicated at this point in time? And I would like to know how many of those that you found in favor of the person filing the complaint, and how many you found in favor of the attorney.
Representative Barnes, I don't have that information in front of me, and I believe it's per quarter, not per year. And I would say that I asked that, and I think the answer was 19 the last quarter were turned into formal complaints, which we are investigating. And the rest were either handled by informal admonition or dismissed as not valid complaints. So it'll be about a third went forward as valid as investigations.
Well, Randall, before you leave, unless you mislead this committee in your testimony, I want you to know that I was part of the Judiciary Committee when we had the Bar Association up for Sunset Review the last time.
Right.
And I do recall at that time that one of the reasons why that there was a big push to sunset the Bar Association was because of its lack of cooperation with the public and having their yearly meetings in Hawaii where the public couldn't participate. And you may have cleaned up a number of those problems, but even in the instance of the Budget and Audit Committee, you were forced into complying. It wasn't something you did voluntarily.
Well, Representative Barnes, I would disagree with the representation that we were forced to do that. That was something we could have gone ahead, obviously, and continued the suit in court. The Bar Association decided, and I think rightfully so, it happens to be my position, that the legislature does have a right to, because this is an integrated bar, a right to audit and do a performance audit on the Bar Association. And it was fortunately at the time in which this issue came up, the majority of the Board of Governors agreed and decided to, it was within our best interest to continue a court case when in fact there seemed to be legitimate public reasons to allow that audit, so that you could, in fact, discover whether or not we were doing what you have asked us to do. And I think, again, the Bar Association has had its ups and downs. We no longer, I think it was in 1980, the resolution was passed prohibiting the Board of Governors to leave the state for meetings. There has been no meetings in Hawaii paid for by the Bar Association since that time. We are, I think, we're sensitive to, and I think, actually, I would agree that the sunset process, while rather a difficult one, was a good one for us, and that it did, I think, point out a lot of areas where we needed to improve. I think that's the purpose of the process. We tried to continue that, and I do think that those people we have, as I indicated in the testimony, hired additional staff to handle the complaints. The court system is being much more active now in supporting the Bar Association in its as I mentioned, two attorneys just in the last, since January this year, have been publicly censured for failing simply to cooperate, not even going to the merits of the investigation, but simply refusing to cooperate with our investigation, and they have been publicly censured for that. And I think there's a real feeling and an attempt to perform our functions responsibly. And as I indicated also in my testimony, we're not saying that we necessarily have always done as well as we could, but we're certainly attempting to change that.
Well, I'm pleased to know that you're attempting to change it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Randall.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate it.
Is there further discussion on this, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just thought I'd correct one of my statements. I may have not sounded too factual when I said the ombudsman does not need to be an attorney, but after reviewing the statute, he does not need to be an attorney. So so he would not have access to the Bar Association records. Of course, unless we change the statute to say he did need to be an attorney, then there would be that argument, but it's not in there now. A layman could be the ombudsman.
Yeah, I don't believe the president ombudsman is an attorney before the last
The president is.
Is he?
Yes, he is.
No, we asked him and he wasn't. I think he's an attorney, but I don't think he's admitted to the last of all.
Well, they've got a 1,865. They got more than
that. There are some that are not, who have graduated from law school but are not admitted to the last of all.
I don't believe that.
No, but we asked him that the day he was here, and I believe he's an attorney, but he's not admitted to the last of all.
You don't have to be an attorney. I'm going to file that off of myself. They've decided not to.
The statutes do give quite a detailed thing about confidentiality by the ombudsman, too. I will go to finance if there's no further questions.
Well, we're about to deal with this legislation.
Mr. Chairman, is there anyone here from the ombudsman's office? The only question, again, that I have any concern about, and it applies, frankly, not only to the Bar Association but to other agencies, is where there are legitimate confidential records, I don't think the bar ought to get them, whether it's,
the ombudsman's office.
The ombudsman. They shouldn't get them, whether they're doctor's records, doctors employed by the state, or lawyers' records.
I wonder
or
if that's not
else.
Something we should be making in the Ombudsman's Act itself and in the definitions of what he can and can't do.
That's why I wish we could ask Jack or somebody whether he thought that was a problem.
Is any bars?
Mr. Chairman, with the document that you gave out to us on page 123, under investigating procedures, down on subsection B, says the ombudsman shall maintain confidentiality with respect to all matters and the identity of the complainants or witness coming before him, except insofar as disclosure may be necessary to enable him to carry out his duties and to support his recommendations.
If I may, I would, I think the privilege that I'm speaking of would not extend to the ombudsman. So I would say that subsection is not, doesn't answer the question because with regard to those confidential physician client or attorney client information, I don't even think the ombudsman should get it. But having said that, I now look in section 170A. It says, subject to the privileges which witnesses have in the courts of this state, the ombudsman may compel by subpoena. That may be the answer to my question.
Yeah.
Because the attorney-client privilege is a privilege recognized in the courts of the state, as is the physician-client privilege and the clergyman privilege and all the rest of it. So maybe that's the answer to my question. Maybe it doesn't need to be answered.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I really had not thought about this. I had talked to the ombudsman's office about this, and there, as far as going into attorney-client relationships and going into personal files, I just really thought that wasn't in the perimeter of what he was thinking. And he felt that this would only amount to probably 9 cases throughout a year anyway, and it'd just be what it does. It puts it in perspective for public.
Jay Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there's no other witnesses. Limit asks unanimous consent to House Bill number 293 enacted relating to the definition of the term of agency in the Ombudsman Act be moved to the committee and asks unanimous consent.
Is there objection? There being none, House Bill 293 Act relating to the definition of the term of agency in the Ombudsman Act be moved to the committee today with individual recommendation. Almost a clear up matter. Committee substitute Senate Bill 86 and House Bill 212 are the Senate and House versions of the same bill. At one time, this committee had passed House Bill 212 from it the same day that we received from the Senate, Senate Bill 86. So we went back up to the finance and got our bill back and brought it back down and rescinded our action on 212. And we added to the Senate bill the item from 212 that the Senate bill didn't have, which appears on page 2, line 12, the Victims Compensation, Crime Victims Compensation Fund. Excuse me. We merely took the Senate bill and added that to it. And that is now before us. I will need to have a motion to adopt the committee substitute, House committee substitute for Senate substitute for Senate Bill 86. Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move and ask unanimous consent that the House Judiciary Committee substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 86 be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Is there objection? There being none,
House in lieu of the original Senate bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, the what we did was just take the add the victims, the Crime Victim Compensation Fund to the Senate bill.
Well, that's already in the Senate bill.
Well, we added it to the body of 212. That's what we did. So the bill should be identical to what went out before with the exception of adding the VICTAP to it.
I don't understand why they need a fund, but I'm not.
We played around with that idea over the testimony, if you remember right, they're always out of money. In fact, the day they testified, I can't remember how many thousands of dollars in claims they were behind. And by the addition of the fund, it gave them additional lever to say, you know, hey, we got 16 applications, and these have all been investigated and found worthy of the right of money. You know, what's the use of having the program? And I think it is a good program.
But does the creation of a fund mean that the unused money automatically transfers into the next fiscal year? Is that the idea? Of course, the problem is they run out of money. The solution isn't having a fund.
Chairman, don't we have a lady here from, I believe that's, are you from the...
She's not here, she has something.
I don't remember what she testified, that they were out of money and couldn't even pay them.
It's not a big deal. I don't think that a fund solves the problem of them being out of money.
I may agree with you. She thinks it's a better deal. So I'll need a motion then to move the House Committee substitute for the Senate bill. Representative Hayes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move and ask unanimous consent that the House Judiciary Committee substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 86 be moved from the Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
Yeah, I'm going to object just for the purpose of a comment. As you may know, this legislation was originally mine 2 years ago, and now is about to pass the Senate bill.
Should you put your name on it?
The only, wish you could. The only part, I'm going to probably do pass if amended, and the part of it that I object to is the mandatory cooperation with law enforcement prosecution officials. I continue to believe that we should not tie the ability to receive this money to the cooperation with law enforcement officials. First of all, I think that you ought to treat all innocent victims the same, and I don't think you're doing that with that amendment. Secondly, I think since they are repeatedly short-funded, there's going to be a great deal of pressure on the board to attempt to weed out as many people as possible. Since there's discretion in the board here, they can interpret what cooperation means, and that effect will be, I think, to weed people out that, in my mind, shouldn't be weeded out. I think that if you're going to have a compensation program, have a compensation program that ought to be separated from the question of prosecuting for the crime itself. That's the language on the bottom of page 1.
Okay, I don't quarrel with that, those thoughts, but I don't know how else we're going to do it. We just need enough money to do it without some sort of framework in to the objection maintained?
Yeah, I'll withdraw my objection.
There's no objection, then the House Judiciary Committee will move the House Committee Judiciary Committee substitute for Senate Committee substitute for Senate Bill 86, and act related to compensation of victims of violent crimes for the community and individual recommendation. The House Bill 345. The House Bill 345 is enacting the victim's rights and sentencing, parole, furloughs, decision, person convicted of a felony, amending Rule 32D, 2 of the Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure. The committee has taken a video of testimony on this bill, and resulting in an extensive committee substitute that's before you in your packet. And Patrick Conheading is here from the Department of Law to discuss this along with other changes. Mr. Conheading, since we are recording electronically, I need you to state your name to the record prior to making a statement on the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Conheading, and I'm in the Department of Law, Attorney General's Office, and I'm more or less in charge of victims' affairs. The committee substitute that you have in front of you was prepared by me, more or less, at your direction, based upon the suggestions that I made at the last committee. I have discussed this with a number of people in the administration. I have discussed it with the representative of the court system, and unfortunately, I was unable to discuss it with Representative Flood, but Representative Flood's office has responded to that proposed committee substitute in a letter. I will try as much as possible to explain the changes here and also to comment on those comments which Representative Flood has sent to you. Basically, Section 1 is a new section, and that was put in at my suggestion, which I think is a very important part of the bill, and that's the requirement of a victim impact statement. I noticed that Representative Flood questioned whether or not we should do this by court rule. I think it would be better to do it by court rule because, as you may know, currently under Alaska statutes, a pre-sentencing report is not required. It is required only by court rule. So if we are requiring as a portion of that pre-sentence report that a victim impact statement be done, I think it's the better part of ensuring that we have something to say that it is amending that court rule that requires a pre-sentence report. Section 2 of the bill is basically the same as that which was contained in the initial bill. I did cut out some language which I felt was superfluous. Section 2 of the bill is a direction to the court that at the time of sentencing they will prepare these comments in accordance with the sentencing report. It is not a pre-sentencing report position. Section 3 is Representative Flood's addition of a aggravating factor. That is changed by the deletion of... Get section 3, that's on page
section 2 of the substitute
is the same as section 1 of the original bill with the exception of the deletion of certain language contained on the original bill, line, page 2, lines 1 and line 3 and 4, that was just superfluous language. Another, the language that, was, that I took out of the proposed original bill read, and other factors relating to the crime, the defendant, disposition of the defendant upon sentencing. That is already done. That is already part of the other portion of the bill.
Right.
See?
Right.
Section 3 is Representative Flood's new aggravating factor. It's the same except for the elimination of physical harm, substantial physical harm, the term substantial physical harm. Basically, physical harm is already an aggravating factor. It's either a part of the offense, an integral part of the offense, or it's covered in one of the other aggravating factors. Again, it was superfluous to put this in as a, put that phrase physical harm in there. I did eliminate section 3 of the original bill, which is this notification situation to the victims of crime. And I think a brief explanation is ordered. I noticed Representative Flood got into it a couple times in his bill too, or in his letter. Basically, the situation would be under this bill that a person is prosecuted and convicted, and it's after the conviction. To, in those situations in which the prosecution felt that the victim's presence would add substantially to the sentencing hearing, we would probably call the those people. An objection that the court system individual raised here in the committee was the fact that oftentimes what you will get are a number of victims coming in, and a lot of what they are saying is repetitive from either things that appear in reports that are before the court or on things that were heard at trial by the judge. And basically what we're looking at is just kind of in a streamlined way, but still having the option to bring that person in front of a sentencing hearing, as well as having those impacts in front of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Otherwise, in Section 3, you're scrubbing out completely that the member of the family is not allowed to even make a statement in the sentencing.
No, I am not eliminating.
I don't mean the whole family get up and raise hands. I mean one statement though, but from the family.
Right. In a sense, what I'm doing is I'm going back to the discretionary function with the prosecutors to bring in those people. Now, what this does is this makes it a right. This gives it a right, which means that if an individual or his family or anybody else wanted to come in and testify at a sentencing hearing, they would do so. And that could, as Ms. Forsythe pointed out, that could really bog down a sentencing proceeding, especially if a lot of what they're going to say has already been heard.
Well, is that 155, do they have that right now to make a statement?
They don't have a right as such.
Well, a privilege.
Well, it's not codified. If a prosecutor doesn't call a person to testify at a sentencing hearing, that person will not be called to testify. That's correct.
No, I don't buy it. I
think
they should have one person in the family should have some say. At least make a statement to the court.
Okay, that's what.
You scrapped it all completely out of here.
That's correct.
I'm really confused.
Everybody,
I'm really confused. When I'm talking about Section 3 now, I'm referring to Section 3 of the original bill that I have eliminated for you. If that is put back in, if this committee deems by medical policy to put that in, that is an inappropriate place to put it because it only applies to aggravating and mitigating factors here in anyway. It should be on any sense in here. It's just as a matter of legislative drafting or legal drafting. In other words, that would only the way it's written, it's in that hearing that is on aggravating and mitigating factors, not at a sentencing hearing, not at a general sentencing hearing.
Well, I'm...
Okay, what do you...
Maybe it's just a bad day for me. Let's look at your CS. We're getting confused on second. Your CS says in section 2
right.
that one of the things that has to be taken into account in the sentencing report
right.
is the statement of the financial, fiscal, and emotional impact on the victim and the victim's family.
That's correct.
Right? That's at the sentencing.
That's correct.
Section 3 of the original bill, which you have eliminated,
that's correct.
Gives them a right to personally appear at sentencing.
That's correct.
Which would be redundant or duplicative of the information that's being provided in the sentencing report.
That'd be provided in the sentencing
report. Same
stage,
right?
Right. Right, exactly.
Except that in the flood version, if I can say that, it's only at the aggravating or mitigating. not necessarily the final.
That's correct. In other words, it wouldn't apply in all situations where a person was sentenced. It would apply only in those
yeah.
situations where there's an aggravated and mitigated factor.
I think he's right. I think he's right. I mean, I think that, first of all, you got the wrong hearing here in the sentencing hearing. And secondly, it's duplicating what we're calling the victim impact statement, which is the statement that tells the court before the court decides on what the sentence is going to be, what damage has been done to the victim.
It's also, if I may, it's also duplicative of Section 2 of, we'll call it the Connedy substitute, if you will, in that statement there. That,
yeah.
that is, in the case of a conviction for a felony offense, that language on line 4 well, through 7 on page 2.
That's the victim impact statement.
That's in part, it's the victim
right.
impact statement.
I guess what I'm trying to say, Representative Liska, is the information gets to them at the appropriate hearing, which is the sentencing hearing.
Okay.
I think I'm caught up now.
Section 4 of my substitute is the same, or almost the same as Section 4 of Representative Flood's original bill. I just changed some of the definition of immediate family along the lines that I suggested last time. Questioning in-laws on one side and yet including legal guardians on the other for those situations where we have, for example, incest cases where we certainly don't want the parent or somebody necessarily testifying as the impact on the victim. Sections 5, 6, 7, and 8 more or less track what the original portion of the bill of Representative Flood's bill did. It's reworked in a little way. It does not grant the victim a veto power, which would be something that would be certainly subject to extreme legal challenge. And probably possibly be viewed by the courts as a due process right. And yet, on the other side, it gives the victim the right to comment upon the potential parole or release, work release, as well as notifying them that the commissioner is, in fact, doing that type of situation, and it requires that the consideration of those comments that are made by the individual. Section 9, of course, is a definition that kind of tracks the Section 5, 6, 7, and 8. It's just an additional definition that I stuck in there. And, of course, Section 10 is the two-thirds vote on the change of the court rule. I'm going to answer any other questions that the committee might have on this or any other comments.
Mr. Cartier, have you seen this listed?
I have that, and I have comments on those too.
Anything wrong?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. On the law draft here, I just have a question. How
how this information gets to the
sentencing court.
Yeah, to the sentencing hearing.
Two ways. Under Section 1 of the bill, which is part of it, the requirement for a victim impact statement.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if the victim was called to testify at sentencing. And also as part of the record on conviction, there's a portion to that that'll be obvious. A person was murdered, you can sit there and say that obviously had a physical impact upon the victim.
Be more specific then. In section 2, page 2 of the law's draft here, lines 4 through 7, there's new subsection 5. That information that appears in the sentencing report, how does it get into the sentencing report? Is it something that is prepared by
That is prepared by the judge as part of the sentencing proceeding. 1255.025A is a requirement that at sentencing a certain report be prepared on everybody who's convicted of a felony. What the courts have done is they utilize the pre-sentence report, which is prepared under Criminal Rule 32D, and then also other statements that are either made at the time of sentencing or that are gleaned from testimony at trial. And basically that's how, for example, subsection 2, let me take subsection 2, which is existing law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Currently in a sentencing proceeding, that is basically what we call the Cheney criteria. And there are certain things that you have to consider in sentencing. Likelihood for rehabilitation, protection of societal norms. There's five criteria that were set down in a case called State v. Cheney a number of years ago. The court sits there and says, okay, are you likely to be rehabilitated? Well, I find that you're not because you have committed three other crimes previously. And that's how this becomes part of the record. That's how this statement becomes part of the record. In much the same way, Section 5, the addition of Section 5 would require a finding on the record regarding the impact on the victim. That would be gleaned again from the victim impact statement, from testimony at trial, or from testimony at the sentencing hearing. It's just a direction to the court that when they do their sentencing record, that they include that victim, that impact on the victim in that.
Mr. Chairman.
Pursuit
a little further. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how does this information, the statement, that in this case I guess the court would place in the findings, in the closing sentence, how do they get a hold of that information in the first place?
The same report to Section 1? Is that the same report?
That is not the same report, but that's where they would get the information. This 025A, Section 025A, which is Section 2 of the bill, is existing law, which requires a sentencing report prepared by the court at sentencing. They include all these things in that sentencing report now. And how they would arrive at the other information would be through at least one additional piece of information which they would be required to have, which would be the victim impact statement, which is required under Section 1 of the bill. That's how they would get that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, explain to Mr. Carnegie, I guess maybe the committee members as well, and including the co-sponsored legislation. I personally don't think it's a good idea, as I read the original, to have the victim or the victim's immediate family to be
in effect, in on the, in on the hearing or the determination of factors in aggravation or mitigation. But I do think that if people want the opportunity to submit some statement, they ought to have that. And I don't see that in the bill now, in the law draft at least. And that's why I keep asking the question, where does this information come from? It comes from, you go back to victim impact statement, it says a probation officer shall prepare the statement, but there isn't any requirement there that the probation officer solicit a statement from the victim.
The way this would be done is in rather than putting the burden upon the victim to come in and make a statement, is to put the burden on the probation service to go out and find out what has happened with that victim. Mm-hmm. And come back and report to the court. Much as they sit there and they investigate the hell out of what this offender has done and say, this is his whole life in front of you. Well, not only this is his whole life, but this is what his actions have done to the victim. In a sense, it probably doesn't, you're right, it doesn't require them to go and talk to a victim.
Yeah, well, my point is that, the person, the victim, may wish to make some sort of a statement on the physical, emotional, financial impact. But I don't see anything in this bill that would allow them the opportunity to provide that information to the probation officer so that it could be included as part of the pre-sentencing report under the victim impact statement. And maybe that's the intent of this, and maybe it somehow does it and I don't see it. On the other hand, I personally don't think it's a good idea to drag the victim into the sentence, directly in the sentencing hearing, but that's just the way I feel about it. I think it's up to the court finally to make it, the determination of sentencing.
Section 1, lines 12, 13, and 14 are fairly broad.
I
don't know how you prepare that without doing those things.
That would be my response.
I
would hope that the probation service would not conduct a victim impact statement without talking to the victim. I mean, I would like to vest them with that much credibility. And I'll be able to.
Yeah, I think we got to rely on somebody here gathering meaningful...
They certainly gather meaningful data when they're preparing a pre-sentence report. And the pre-sentence report, doesn't sit there and say you have to talk to the offender.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to expanding that language, but I don't know how you'd expand it to make it say any more than it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Talk
down
about the
proxy
amendments.
You want me to present them?
Yes.
I have a question first, which I just thought of. The Conheady substitute, page 1, line 18 and 19, the additional language there. I think that's a mistake because Section 025A now, without that language, requires a sentencing report for any case where the imprisonment is exceeding 90 days or a violation of Title 44. We are limiting it by the addition of that language to only felony offenses.
Or a sentence of imprisonment exceeding 90 days.
You think
you're
that there might be a felony case
you're expanding
where there won't be a sentence of imprisonment
exceeding 90 days? There are a number of felony cases that are felony sentences that are handed down where there is no prison time. This expands it, it doesn't contract.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if we could look at my amendments.
Yes.
should be in your packet.
Now, the line references are all mixed up because they were made to the original bill and not the committee substitute.
Well, perhaps
but let me,
it's good to pass here. You can fire them down.
Yeah, I've got them.
It's not been messed up too bad.
No, it's not too far off. The purpose of the First Amendment, Mr. Chairman, is basically in the victim impact statement to be more specific about the information required in that statement. This additional language with a slight variation should go, I think, two places in the committee substitute. The first place would be page 1, starting on line 14, and it would have to be slightly rewritten there. And then the second place, it should substitute for the language on page 2, lines 4 through 7. And if you will look, Mr. Chairman, at the language there and compare it to mine, I will point out the differences. This language that I'm offering, by the way, is the identical language in federal legislation that's been adopted on victim impact statement, on the victim impact statement. So this is taken from an approved federal law. The word verified is added. It's verified information rather than simply a statement. Secondly, the addition of the term non-argumentative style so that it will be consistent with the rest of the sentencing report or pre-sentencing report, which is not presented in an argumentative style. Thirdly, social impact is added and medical impact is added. And finally, the court may, in particular situations, require additional information about the victim that's appropriate to that victim's particular circumstances. So you've got the catch-all of such other information as may be required. I think that's more precise. It's in line with the federal law on the same subject.
Did the court hear that right now?
That's the federal law in federal court.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have, during the testimony, looked through a rather lengthy letter from the prime sponsor of this bill. And now we've got several lengthy amendments here from Representative Clarkson. And I don't believe that there's anyone from the prime sponsor here. And what I thought might be appropriate, I'd like to ask you that at this time, if maybe we can get the prime sponsor of this bill together with Mr. Clarkson, Conhaney, and come up with something the prime sponsor could agree on put before.
I thought he would certainly be here at this point. Maybe he'll come down here. Is everybody with you?
Not necessarily in direct response, but I recall that the opening testimony by the original sponsor specifically addressing the interest of Representative Clarkson to offer amendments. He said he was open specifically to the amendments that Clarkson would offer, is what I recall.
That was pretty close to what he said.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Plus, I've made a couple of attempts to talk to Joe about this. Our staff have talked about them, so his staff's familiar with the amendments that we're offering, but we've never gotten to the point that you're suggesting, which is actually sit down and agree and disagree on them. We just haven't had the chance to do that.
Maybe I can strike some middle ground here. Philosophically, I'm a lot more comfortable with the laws saying in several parts than I am with the original bill. I really am. Better put together. I have read these, and I don't exactly know how they mesh together.
Well, let me make my pitch.
In the interest, what I'm saying is, in the interest of time, why don't we do that? I'll make sure that Mark can spend some time tomorrow with you, sometime to save the committee the time of wrangling it through. I don't really, if I remember right, the statement was about like Representative Whitman said he didn't have any philosophical disagreement with them all. Now that we have a different line draft, the work with. Maybe in the next day, and our staff and maybe Mark can get together, and like in the first order of business Friday, maybe we can continue to treat this legislation and move it through the system. Unless there's objection, we're on track, and that's what I'd like to see done. That's probably the best for all of us. We are getting leaning on until 3 o'clock, and we are kind of cleaning down as we go here to work for.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't had a chance to look at these representative clocks on the mainland. It looks to me like it didn't get it here until just to sat down. How long have these been available? But I'd like to have a chance to read these over, see what we've got amongst all of them here. Apparently, he must have put some new language in something.
Yep.
On your number five, on your second page here. The right to have any stolen or other personal property returned expeditiously. That's that it wasn't in the original bill either. But have you went over with Representative Passenger about that?
Flood is a prime sponsor, and that's why I said I've tried to talk with him. We've talked at the staff level, but I haven't had a chance to talk to Joe in any detail, except this morning to confirm what he testified to here, which is these open amendments.
Well, maybe three down Friday, you guys can work that through, and we'll try to treat this as first order of business. So if I get close to 3 o'clock, and everyone has a busy afternoon, including me, in the, just before we adjourn, HC 34, which is this rule change, we did a redraft in it after all the little talk we had. We did not address Rule 52. Which Representative Hayes had some questions about. We did kind of scrub up a document so that we got one better to work at. And it's kind of important. It's not something that we're going to treat right now. I'm just telling you that we did that. We had a number of little words we wanted to slide around when we did that in this work document. But if I remember right, Representative Hayes had some stuff he wanted to do with regard to Rule 52, for it, and even Rule 39B. But I went back and put postponed on page 3 and the 24-hour deal on page 3 and the other words that we inserted in to clean that up. I just wanted you to be aware of that, and if those of you who have particular interest in those rules and try to work those through a bit, we'll try to get those cleaned up so we can address these rule changes with some degree of dispatch.
Rule 54, I think, was the one that there was some concern expressed about.
15 and 54. I have a lot of scratching on mine, so. We have changed the number of words.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think I should write Rule 52. I thought was a good amendment because we're not really following it. I haven't been following it anyway. And 54, I had some concerns about whether that was when we wanted to. That was a good amendment to Rule 54. I'll take this with me.
Yeah, maybe we can put a little bit of effort into it. And like, it won't take as long to deal with it if we can pick up some of the individuals. And as much as I dislike doing it, the other matters on today's calendar will continue into tomorrow's calendar. There's a shorter calendar tomorrow. And hopefully we'll be able to deal with these things and have it today. I'm really sorry about that.
What's your plan with regard to 326? Are we going to have any more hearings on that?
Tomorrow. We'll continue until tomorrow. And 323 into tomorrow. And we'll try to.
That's the one that, I don't know if you recall, that we spent about 4 years on that, and some of the same people may want to testify on
that. We've got some of the same folks
that's
here.
That's the Exemptions Act.
The Department of Law has been really patient with us the last day or two waiting for it, and they haven't gotten around to the attorney to be there. I'm sorry.
I don't think for the truth. I was going to be there.
Well, Dick's here on both, I think.
This is on the 6th.
So if there's nothing further to come before the 3rd, this time we adjourn to 1:30.